Here and now, listeners who love language, and judging from your notes to us, that's a big crowd, listen up. You know that word that you hate, like? Like, you really hate, like? Well, it's actually an important discourse marker. It's not going anywhere. Or when someone uses literally when the thing isn't literal, hey, bad now means good. Awful used to mean filled with awe. So get with the times. Same thing with ums and vocal fry and dude. Our next guest says all are part of a beautiful evolving language. Linguist Valerie Friedland takes a deep dive into the history of words. Her book is Like Literally Dude, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. And you said my title so beautifully. I love your intonation.
Well, oh, thank you. And this is our sandbox here. We just love this. So start with literally. Someone saying, I was literally out on a ledge over something when they were nowhere near a ledge. I think it's even banned in the NPR style book. And you write about a bar with a sign in New York?
Yes, there was a bar with a sign in New York that said if you used literally, figuratively, you might as well just leave. And we are really upset by people that use literally, figuratively, which is funny because there's so much of language that we use figuratively without realizing that it once meant something different. So, for example, something that might be relevant to NPR, the word broadcast in the 1850s, do you have any idea what that meant originally?
Throw seeds out.
That's exactly right. To throw seeds. I'm impressed. To throw seeds out. But now it means to disseminate information, a metaphorical extension of its original use.
And we just want to take a second because, as you are saying, there are those who think literally can only mean in the actual exact sense. For a demonstration of that, we turn to the great linguist Weird Al Yankovic.
Just now, you said, you literally couldn't get out of bed. Really makes me want to literally smack a crowbar upside your stupid head.
Everybody sing. and so there's someone who's outraged by it, but you say literally has become an intensifier. What is that?
Intensifiers are words like completely, absolutely, horribly, or the well-worn very and really. Basically, they help boost or amplify what you're trying to say. And they add that little extra oomph so that people that are listening to you know it wasn't just your everyday average event. It was something a little special. When you use literally as an intensifier, you're basically using it as a degree word, very much like very. And very had a very different meaning back in the old English days, where it meant true or actual, pretty much the same way literally does for us today. Mm. But it has semantically bleached over time, meaning it's gotten removed from that original meaning, and we don't remember when that happened, so it doesn't bother us. Literally is still in the process of doing that, and that's why it bothers us.
Oh, it's fascinating. As is which I just said in getting ready to say, I said, you call this a filled pause, an or an in a pause. You say this is not nothing. It is signifying something. Something complex is coming or a new topic. And both the speaker and the listener unconsciously know that that's a signal.
Yes, I think and are the most underrated speech features, and we work so hard to get rid of them. But I think we haven't really looked at what they're doing for us. They signal when a speaker is doing some very heavy cognitive retrieval. So or seem to appear more often before hard words, more less common words, also abstract words, or very, very complex sentences. So that's a pretty good indicator that someone's working hard in their conversation with you.
And you back up all of this with tons of research that people have. But I want to move on to a third rail, if you will. So let's touch it. It's vocal fry. So hated that the public radio show This American Life devoted an entire segment to the letters they got complaining about women and their vocal fry. Here's Mickey Meek. Her sound just outraged listeners.
She'd never experienced anything outside the church, and she basically checked out on Will and the Kids.
On Will and the Kids, going down at the end of the sentence.
Well, vocal fry is a funny feature because when it's been studied in the past, and that means before the 2000s, it was actually looked at as a feature that was more predominant in men's speech rather than women's. And it was generally associated with being higher status and carrying authority and weight. But flash forward to the 2000s, where we see it mainly talked about in women's speech, and it's become an epidemic, which is something that was never used to describe it when it was associated with British men, which is where it seems to have started. But vocal fry is actually an attempt by women to please the naysayers who don't like the high-pitched, squeaky women's voice, long described as shrill or high-pitched or squeaky, and especially in broadcasting. So it seems like this idea of vocal fry being a negative thing only occurred when women started to adopt it to slightly lower their pitch to come across as more professional and authoritative.
It's sort of like you can't win. You write about how women's voices have always been more policed than men's, but also that women and young people in general tend to come up with these changes in the language, and they are not thanked for it.
Absolutely. If we look at research on who leads in language change and has historically, not just in modern speech, we find one recurrent trend, that it's young people and particularly young women that lead in language change, not just in the changes we don't like literally like and vocal fry, but in changes that have come to be the language we all speak. So for example, moving from ye to you, saying things like does instead of doth, my instead of mine in like mine eyes. These are changes we've all embraced, and that seems to be what happens over time. The problem is that we also culturally tend to disfavor women's voices and have historically. So this underlying cultural prejudice or bias we have about women's voices, particularly in professional spheres, affects how we view the features that they bring into language and affects how we see them as contributors to English. So it's unfortunate for women that they happen to be both culturally not well accepted in certain places, but also innovators in language, so they get more noticed for that as well.
Oh. A notable exception, though, to all of this is the word dude, made famous in films like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and The Big Lebowski. Here in that film, Jeff Bridges and Sam Elliott.
Take it easy, dude.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you will.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
The dude abides. You do the history of so many of these words. The word duty actually led us to dude. Explain.
Yes. Can you imagine if instead of calling each other dude, our adolescent children called each other duty? I don't think they'd be quite so popular. The funny part about dude is it actually comes from Yankee Doodle Dandy. It's a fusing together of the doodle and the dandy, and it seemed to have first started surfacing as duty that then got shortened to dude.
I just want to spend a minute on the singular they to describe someone identifying as non-binary. Now, this isn't about whether or not there should be a word for people who are non-binary. You all for that, but it's a discussion of which word is chosen. And many were tried before they.
Hundreds were tried before they. And I think people don't realize that. The reason they has been successful is it was an organic development in language. And we find, if we look back through the history of language, that it's almost always an organic development that leads to new words being adopted. It's sort of like Klingon. You can't just enforce it and say everybody should speak Klingon. It's not going to happen. You need to have something that users themselves create because it meets the needs that they have. And that seems to be what they has done. It has done it when it was part of the worthiness doctrine in the 1600s that he was supreme and more worthy than she. People started to say, okay, well, that's okay if you want to think that, but I feel invisible and I want to use they instead of he because I feel I should be seen in this language. They had those discussions as early as 1600. Mm. It's now sort of shift in who we're referring to with they, but it's the same underlying motivation of why people have adopted a pronoun that already existed in the language. And I think what we forget is that you has changed drastically over the history of English, and you used to refer to plural only and only in object position, and now it can be singular or plural and in subject position, and that happened organically as well. Mm. So we can't force language. It has to evolve on its own, and sticking in weird words that we don't recognize or feel any empathy with is not going to ever be the organic development of language that they has become.
That's Valerie Friedland, a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada. She also writes a language blog on Psychology Today, Language in the Wild. Her book is Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Valerie, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Later, dude, I think is the only appropriate way to go off.